Check, hey, check 1, 2.
All right. Morning, all. Well, Shireen, you don't even have to be in the same room to know what I'm doing, apparently. Yes, the family band made me cry. I figure if Abby singing "This Is the Sound of One Voice" does not like break the internet, then the internet has no soul. Oh my word. Anyway. As always, thanks to the whole gang of you. That was beautiful, and I wouldn't have missed it for the world. I was thinking, that I was watching the kids in the background singing along, like just right in there, and Cheryl singing Jaylene's song "Find Us," which has all these different ways and places that we might be found by whatever we call more, by God, by the divine, by life, by energy, by love, all these different ways we might be found and all these different places we might be found. And I'm watching the four of you make music together, and I'm thinking, it might be an awkward thing to try to put on the list, but if that's not being found, if that's not being found by love right there, I don't know. I don't know where one might go to find it. I was just so struck by that. I was thinking that in a way that I don't want to just fall headlong into nostalgia here. However, sort of this image of the family singing around the piano together, which you are all were doing, is not a unique or new image, but the ability to go back 30 years from now, 40 years from now, 70 years from now, and see that moment again and be aware of the beauty of it and the poignancy of it, that is a bit unique to our time. And I wish I could sort of see far enough down the road to have some inkling of what it will be like for Owen and Abby, in particular in this instance, but many people. To be able to go back to some of those moments and deeply know in our souls that love was finding us right there, right then. So good. So good. Anyway, welcome, all of you. And Cheryl, Zach, Abby, and Owen, thanks for making us all feel drawn right in. So beautiful. Zach, thanks for hosting our community time. And thanks for reminding us all that that it's not a concurrent event. I mean, it happens at a certain time, but you don't have to be there at that time to be a part of sharing your life with the community, and you can do that through Facebook. You're also very welcome, of course, to do that by emailing me, and having me kind of pass those things along to the community, or text me or whatever, if Facebook isn't your thing, and you're listening to this on the podcast or whatever. Want to take the time to note that when we gather on Treaty One land. We continue to be made welcome, and I continue to be grateful for that. Getting issues like land settlement, I mean, land settlement is an above the waterline on the iceberg kind of issue, that the big stuff's maybe out of view far too often. But that's an issue that's in view, and when we note that we are gathering on Treaty One land, we help to keep it in view. Getting big issues like that sorted, that's really long haul stuff. Those are long haul exercises in courageous justice. They're not the kind of things that you make progress on by backing away from them. And one small way that we can stand in solidarity with those at the forefront of big issues like land claims is by reminding one another that the work of moving forward is ongoing. And when we remind one another of that, it helps us to be present both to the initiatives themselves and to the people who, in a frontline sort of way, in a first person sort of way, are wrestling with these things all the time. And one way that we can do that as a community is by stopping to recognize that the matter of keeping our word, of acting out the things we said, which is the way treaties are supposed to work, is essential to moving forward, even on things that can seem intractable. And that's a theme that we're going to be spending more time with this morning. So before we do that, let's take some moments to breathe together, and then we'll get into our exploration. Three rounds of square breathing, in for a count of three, cradle our breath for a count of three, out for a count of three or six, or till you're empty, and then around again, so three times. And I would encourage us this morning, if you wish to participate in this and you want another symbol, I would encourage you to take your hands and just put them on either side of your I'm going to say your mind, but your brain, as a way of being conscious of keeping in mind the things that we said we would do, the commitments that we've made to dealing with difficult things, whether those are personal or collective. All right, so with this in mind, let's breathe together. Thank you. Good to breathe with you. Okay. You know, different things come to mind, right? When we stop for a few moments like that, sometimes our brains can be so busy. And so this morning I had to note and sort of wave off, just acknowledge and move on from the thought that I hope that in their life of making whatever they make, but maybe it'll include some music, that Abby and Owen get to the point in their careers where they get paid with more than Pringles. Oh, man. Anyway, I don't know if that's how that arrangement worked, but that's what came to my mind. And also, you may want to check the website, the Facebook page, rather, for Misty's pro tip for Zoom meetings and jammies. I just keep hearing from more and more people who are like, I love this online thing. I mean, not that we're not missing being together. Of course we are. But I love this online thing because I can like lay in bed with my coffee and my jammies and, you know, and be there for what's going on. Yeah, that's pretty great, right? Anyway, Misty's pro tip was that if you wear a hoodie with the hood up over your jammies, that'll do for a Zoom meeting. So there you go. Hot tip, hot Zoom meeting tip of the week from Misty. I was at the optometrist's office last week, and I have been seeing the same optometrist, sometimes more clearly, sometimes less so, for decades. He honestly is great. He feels like a family friend at this point. And I mean, he is sort of knows our whole family and our optical history. We always end up having quite a chat about things other than my vision. My vision being something that he likes to characterize as being from the dark side. So we got going to other topics. Take care of the business at hand, and then we have a good chat. We're a similar age. He's a few years older than I am, but our kids are similar ages and so on. So quite a bit in common. This particular visit, we ended up talking a bit about the uncertainty of life. It wasn't what I would call a morbid conversation. It wasn't a downer. Our focus wasn't on negativity. It was on honesty. And in particular, we talked about how it's one thing to know life is uncertain in our mind. It's another matter entirely to know that life is uncertain because we've experienced the uncertainty. And it's an oversimplification, but perhaps a helpful one to suggest that one of these ways of knowing we can sort of keep in our head, but the other one we tend to know in our bodies. One of them we might think about as having to do with being. The other we might tend to think about as having to do with doing. And again, it's more complex than that, and reducing large ideas to just contrasting either or ones can really go off the rails easily. But contrasting things can also help us to examine them. So for that reason, let's take that comparison. I find it interesting that one of the ways we characterize the community of the table, at least online, is we characterize ourselves as a group of people that embrace doubt and uncertainty. And I think it's fair to say that if that's the case, we have a lot to get our arms around these days, even with all the physical distancing we're doing. When we embrace things like doubt and uncertainty, one of the areas of our life that can really take a beating is hope. And this is, of course, not unique to the people that think of the table as their community. This is everywhere these days. Here's how writer Brian Bethune sums up the dilemma in a recent article of his entitled Have a Little Hope. He writes, "In a world scarred by a pandemic, inexorably consuming lives and livelihoods, ongoing racial and indigenous injustice, 25 million refugees adrift from their homes, and escalating climate change, despair can be a force as powerful as the fifth horseman of the apocalypse. Many of us have come to regard hope with disdain," writes environmentalist Thomas Homer Dixon, one of the most prominent public intellectuals in Canada, in his new book, Commanding Hope. He goes on to describe hope as a state of mind that's naive and irresolute at best, delusional at worst. That's a pretty powerful summation and, rather bleak as well. To regard hope as a state of mind that's naive and irresolute at best, delusional at worst, I would say is arguably to have lost hope. Just as an aside, Homer Dixon does not end up in a place without hope, but in a place with a very complex sort of understanding of hope in that book. Bethune, in the article, goes on to reflect on different ways people are reacting to that litany of challenges that he lays out. He talks about climate despair, the kind of depression Greta Thunberg experienced as an 11-year-old when she first learned about climate change and she just stopped eating and speaking for some time. He talks about what historian Stuart Parker calls climate nihilism, which is people literally believing nothing about the climate crisis. Parker says it this way. He says they simply excise it from their consciousness so that there's no way it actually affects their decision-making. That's maybe like the sort of indifference that we were exploring the other week, but taken to the next level. And there are others, Bethune notes, that instead of looking away, have stared right down the barrel of the problems, but have concluded that the human species is basically the equivalent of a failed state, that we made this mess, we're refusing to acknowledge it, and we'll perish from it. End of human story. Wow. Thanks for getting out of bed for that, eh? We had a leadership team meeting last week, as you may have noticed if you keep up on recent Facebook activity on the table's Facebook page. And I want to tell a little story about that. But before I do, can I just say how much I appreciate that group of people? I enjoy working with our leadership team. I really do. I know so many folks that do what I do and work with leadership groups that are just the most challenging sort of politicized, religiously hidebound. It's a grind, and nothing could be further from my experience. I'm really grateful. So thank you in particular to Tim Penner and to Brent and Karen Johnson and to Judy and Justin and Ariel. You are people in my life that help me continue to feel hope, even when things look a bit grim. Thank you. I really love working with you guys. In any event, one of the things on our agenda when we met was to brainstorm ideas about what we could do to engage the littles under the circumstances. And we're working on some ideas. I see emails circulating, more of that to come in the days and weeks ahead. In the course of that conversation, Ariel, whose work is typically with an older adult population, talked about how much she misses being around the kid energy of the table. Andreas shared something similar from a different vantage point on our Facebook page this past week. And then Karen, in that meeting, who's a teacher and is surrounded by, you know, kid energy all the time, both at work and at home, offered a couple of sort of balancing stories about the challenges of directing that energy in constructive ways while also trying to honor the necessary safety guidelines in the classrooms. She honored the confidence of that's her trust as a teacher, and also managed to tell some really pretty funny stories about some of the things that are part of having a room full of kids in masks under your care. Anyway, all in all, it was a very intriguing conversation. And here's the thing that connects it, for me, that connects it to hope. That conversation was about the kids. It was about our young ones. It was about the littles, the children. When people give up hope, children stop being made welcome. And that happens. That is happening. That's happening enough in our culture at the moment that there's a name for it, that it's a movement. To look at our kids with hopeful eyes is to entertain the possibility of a future, and even perhaps a better future. If there are kids in your life that you love and enjoy, whether you think of them as your kids or otherwise, then there's a different kind of motivation, it seems to me, to ask, what does hope look like under these circumstances? What does it mean? How could it thrive? I want to explore some of those questions more, but before I do, I feel like I need to address myself to a bit of a religion issue. Religion, in my case, most directly experienced within pretty traditional Christian theology, has tended to treat hope as a state of being. The short, colloquial version might be something like, be people of hope. Or just this, you know, you are people of hope. Because no matter what happens, in the end, God is going to fix everything. In religious language, we can call it resurrection, we can call it rapture, we can call it heaven, we can call it eternity. I think the Anglican prayer book uses the phrase something like the sure and certain hope of resurrection. So that's kind of, you know, Christian theological language for that idea. And seen from those sort of points of view, hope really doesn't need any evidence in the here and now to be believed. We're just invited and expected even to take this proffered solution, you know, on faith. So perhaps it really isn't any sort of surprise that those who don't share that particular worldview or who push back on that worldview might say, as the notably gloomy 19th century German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer has said, that, quote, hope deranges the intellect, leading us to confuse what we want with what is liable to occur. Again, in sort of more colloquial language, if you really think that your imaginary friend in the sky is going to swoop down and fix everything that we've messed up, you're confusing wishful thinking with the facts. That kind of thinking can also keep us from attending to the reality and the potential beauty of the present moment. The kind of thinking that locates hope somewhere else as a state of being is what I mean. Because it constantly keeps moving our hope to some other time and some other place. This is also something that Buddhism addresses itself to quite consistently, the idea that that kind of hope can be the sort of attachment that creates suffering rather than alleviating it, because it keeps us from being present to the moment that we're in. Which might beg the question, how do we think about or enact hope if we don't happen to hold those sorts of religious views? I know there are lots of us in this community for whom traditional views of God, the afterlife, the end of the world, all those kinds of things have gone or are going through all kinds of revisions. So we might find ourselves feeling like we're sort of floating around in an ill-defined ill-defined space between established worldviews. We're kind of like in this. I heard somebody this past week describe it as being like being in a drawer full of spices, where you kind of, oh, I have some of this spice, some of that spice, and you still end up with something very tasty, but it's different than saying this is the flavor of what I believe. So if we find ourselves in a space like that, where the sort of short form religious answers are not working anymore, how might we think about hope? Well, if you like poetry, you're in for a treat this morning. I think we could do worse than to begin with a short poem. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that keeps so many warm. I've heard it in the chillest land and on the strangest sea, yet never an extremity it asked a crumb of me. That's Emily Dickinson's poem from the mid-1800s entitled Hope is the Thing with Feathers. Hope, Dickinson suggests, lives in the soul. It doesn't live there because we make it so, and it's extremely difficult to do in. Its song continues even under the most challenging and weirdest circumstances, even when big things like the sea are acting strange. It's not there to ask for something. It's there to guide us through adversity, and its song is never sweeter than in the middle of the storm. That's a rather lovely picture of the nature of hope, something that lives deep within and that we should not hesitate to look to as a precious resource when the going gets tough. But is that the whole story? There's this mysterious song in our hearts, and we just need to pay attention to hear it, and we'll be kept warm enough, strong enough to go on. Is that sort of the whole deal? And does that connect? How does that connect to questions we might have about enacting hope, about engaging with things that seem overwhelming and intractable in ways that demonstrate hope, that put wheels on hope, if you will, skin on hope? There's an interesting collection of sayings in the book of Proverbs that I want to reference on that question. And I do this with a sense of both intrigue and trepidation. My sense of intrigue is there because this collection addresses itself quite creatively to this question, to this realm of questioning. And the trepidation is there because this is a text that has been used to dictate certain values and gender roles to women in particular, in ways that I would say are narrow-minded and patriarchal and abusive. And if you've had those experiences, you'll know who you are as soon as I mention the text. If that's you and this is a triggering thing or a really powerfully, profoundly negative, irredeemable chunk of text, then just roll over in bed and put your feet on the floor and go get a fresh cup of coffee and come back. We're not going to stay here for the whole balance of the time. But I think there is something here. If, on the other hand, you want a little different reading than the one that you got thumped over the head with, then stick around. The text is the last two-thirds of Proverbs 31, that whole chapter being titled The Sayings of King Lemuel, and identified as, quote, an oracle his mother taught him. The first part of it is by, like, if you're going to be a king, don't be drunk, because being a hungover leader is a bad idea. You're not going to make good decisions. Also, watch out for predatory, in this case, women. So good mom advice, right? Anyway, that's the first section. It's the next section that got my attention. And it got my attention because of the way it speaks to the question of how might we enact hope under circumstances where all is not well, where an ideal has not been realized. And it might even be in view. It is in this text. Interestingly enough, the ideal's in view, but not yet realized. And so there's this little hinge verse in the text that was what sort of caught my eye and slowed down my traffic and made me pay attention to the whole collection. In verse 25, this remarkable person that's being described as a wife of noble character here is described as someone that is, quote, clothed with strength and dignity, someone that can, quote, laugh at the days to come. In many translations, that is rendered, can laugh at tomorrow. And that poetic image gestures towards someone that's not afraid of the future, someone that operates with an internal sense of strength and of hope. Now, again, I'm going to get into this in a bit here, but if anyone has ever used this text as a concrete list of things you need to do as a woman to make a man happy, or to make God happy, or to just be a good person, and set it up as a rule book against which to judge yourself or to judge others, I'm going to just flat out say that, in my opinion, they have missed the point of the text by a mile, and badly misused it. Well, they've just read it literally, you know, which is a bad idea with poetry. Anyway, I'm not going to take the time to get into that this morning. Maybe you feel like I just did, but trust me, that was the above the waterline part. You can read it for yourself. But here's the thing. By the end of that collection, we realize that the idealized, in this case, female character is not only an exceptional person, they are also considered by the oracle in this binary cultural setting in which this text is written. They are considered by the oracle in that culture to be the equal of the male in every way that matters. And this is not an egalitarian culture by a long shot. Women are property in this culture. And by the end of the collection, it's clear that the oracle considers genders equal and includes that to such a degree that within the text, they recognize that equality, even though the culture is not yet structured that way. And the imagery in the text, if you want to get into it, is this image of the men sitting at the gate and the women not being at the gate. So the town council is all male. You know, the power brokers are all guys. And then there's everybody else. And by the end, even though the structure hasn't changed in the culture, so the women are still not sitting on the council has acknowledged that they, not in so many words, but in all the ways that matter regarding the equality of persons and the contribution of persons, that they should be, and we're not there yet. That's interesting, right? So there's kind of this slow cultural curve that's happening, and at the same time, the wise one, the oracle, is saying, can we just recognize that this is the case and start to structure it that way, please? Can we get on with this? Can we change the structure so that the thing that we can see is the thing that's right in view as better, as just, as right can be enacted? So that's an interesting space, right? In other words, there's no requirement that we read these wise words as being about gender roles any more than we need to understand the Dickinson's hope in her poem to be a literal bird. This is not the point. This is about character, period. This is about a virtue, period. It's aspirational, and it's for all humans, regardless of how they identify when it comes to gender or sex roles. And here's what we can learn about the tricky question regarding whether hope is primarily about being or primarily about doing. I don't want to make this all about math. Again, not a good way to approach poetry, but by way of illustrating the emphasis in the text, here's one way to come at it. There are 21 verses in this section, the way it's rendered in most translations, and depending how you read it, at least 13 of the 21 are descriptions of doing, of concrete, enacted expressions of what hope for tomorrow looks like, how it behaves. And those instances are about things that are both as ordinary as caring well for a household, the food is on the table and the laundry is being done and people are well clothed for what they need to do and all of that everyday business of a household. And there's also a big chunk of text in there that are about doing business. They're about buying and selling. They're about things that are as much about dignity and strength, sort of character regardless of enactment, as they are about things like calling the realtor so you can sell one house and buy another. It's this really intriguing mix of being and doing. In other words, to be a person of hope, considered from that vantage point, is to act as a person with hope. Or to put it in reverse, we're not going to act as persons of hope unless we have hope to enact. It's a both and it's complicated. Now, in the reading I was doing on this week, I ran across something that hadn't occurred to me before. Not an unusual occurrence, by the way. But this idea really struck me because hope as a pop idea can get lost right here. It's important not to confuse hope with optimism. Hope is a very grounded in the real kind of virtue. It's a very head up, eyes open kind of virtue. Harvard professor Cornel West, one of America's most prominent black intellectuals, makes this very clear. And he illustrates it from the struggle for black equality this way. He writes, "Optimism for me has never been an option because there's too much suffering in the world. Think of all the African bones and bodies at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. But hope is something else, because hope is not spectatorial, it's participatory. Hope is a verb as much as it's a virtue. Hope is as much a consequence of your action as it is a source of your action." Wow. Hope is not spectatorial. He may have made that word up, but it's a good one. Hope is not spectatorial, it's participatory. Hope is a verb as much as it's a virtue. Hope is as much a consequence of your action as it is a source of your action. In other words, hope lives in a space much like that ill-defined one I referred to earlier, a space between optimism and hopelessness, a space where our heads are up, our eyes are open to the challenges, and in which the song of hope is not extinguished but continues, even though it is without words, to get us up in the morning, to keep us caring for others, and also receiving others' care with grace, that doesn't stop even when the reality we face may chill us to the bone or toss us around in truly unpredictable and frightening ways. To reference the collection in Proverbs, hope keeps us acting out equality even when we know not all the people in the story are being treated with equals. It keeps us working for a better tomorrow even when that work makes great demands and shows little result. Hope is a verb as much as it's a virtue. Hope is as much a consequence of your action as it is a source of your action. I want to leave us with those ideas to wrestle with and explore with another sort of poem. This one from the giant in poetry, the Irish poet Seamus Heaney. This is from his poem, The Cure for Troy. And as you listen to this, I want to encourage us to think of hope as a verb, as something that comes into being as we do it, and at the same time, a pragmatic necessity, we need hope, and a profound mystery. Here then, a little bit from Seamus Heaney. History says, don't hope on this side of the grave. But then, once in a lifetime, the longed-for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. So, hope for a great sea change on the far side of revenge. Believe that a further shore is reachable from here. Believe in miracles and cure and healing wells. Very beautiful, very powerful, very willing to live in the space, the ill-defined, sometimes confusing, confounding space between optimism and hopelessness, a space where we need hope to enact hope, and we need to enact hope to have it grow, to have it be in us and for us. Well, peace, everybody, in the midst of wrestling with all that we're wrestling with these days. I hope that we've been able to explore hope a little bit this morning in a way that doesn't feel blithe on the one hand or judgmental on the other, but that keeps us in this space where we can genuinely, authentically, in one another's presence, in community, wrestle with things like finding hope and enacting it. God knows, we don't have to imagine that we need it at the moment. We can see that we do. And not just we, but all those around us. So, the best to all of you and all of us as we seek to believe that a further shore is reachable from here.